IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Welcome to All Things Policy. As you definitely know by now, every Friday we tend to sit back and talk about interesting things that catch our fancy from various fields of Indian history, especially since I'm the one in charge of this medieval South Indian history. And today we have something quite interesting lined up for you, where we're going to be exploring two of what are perhaps today, India's most influential religions today, Sri Vaishnavism and Veerashaivism. And I'm going to be exploring an aspect of them that I think is not very often kind of touched upon. And that is how these religions kind of interacted with the state structures of the medieval period. I have with me today Revant Utkalam and Prateek Murli. Prateek and Revant are history students and massive nerds who I know from Instagram. They also host a very interesting podcast called Pravaha, which is a discussion kind of podcast which explores various aspects of Indian history and religion. Again, mostly in the medieval period. So as you can imagine, that's something that I totally geek out about. So thank you both so much for being here, Revant and Prateek. Welcome to All Things Policy.
Hi, we're also really happy to be here.
It's our pleasure. So let's start out by like laying a little bit of context for our discussion, right, guys? So we're going to be looking at South India in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. The beginning of a lot of the threads that we're going to kind of unravel over the course of this conversation are in the 11th century. The 11th century is a very interesting time. There's all these like crazy wars and expeditions happening. You might want to listen to like older episodes of All Things Policy or to the Yodha podcast where Aditya Ramnathan and I have talked about this in quite a lot of detail. But the TLDR of it is that by the end of the 11th century, you had two very large kind of imperial formations that dominated most of India south of the Narmada River. One of them was the Chalukya imperial formation, which was centered around Kalyana in the Deccan. And the second was the Chola Empire, centered around Gangaikonda Cholapuram in the Kaveri River Valley, which had authority over considerable swathes of the southern tip of India and parts of the east coast of India at its peak. Now, both the Cholas and the Chalukyas as imperial families were major, major patrons of Shiva. Most of the extraordinary temples of the 11th century, such as the Brihadeeshwara temple in Tanjavur, were built in honor of Shiva. And it was really the Shaivites who kind of controlled the reins of political power and kind of had a significant presence in all kinds of arms of government. So you would see Shaiva rulers, you would see Shaiva generals, you would see Shaiva priests holding very high positions of authority. I think it's also important to keep in mind that when we talk about a state in the medieval period, we're not talking about the state in the same sense as we think about states today. These are not kind of all-encompassing bureaucracies that command absolute obedience over enormously diverse populations. They're very much kind of family enterprises centered around various political entrepreneurs who also have managed to kind of establish alliances with other political entrepreneurs in various parts of their territories and who managed to kind of establish a stranglehold over agrarian resources. They don't necessarily have a monopoly over violence the way that modern states do. And so when just keep that in mind when we talk about states over the ensuing half an hour or so. So what happens late in the 11th century and early in the 12th century is that two very remarkable kind of religious movements begin to emerge. The first, especially led by the great theologian Ramanuja, and the second, the Veerashaivas, led by a whole bunch of very, very prolific poets across various social backgrounds. And both of these would in various ways kind of challenge the socio-political order that had hitherto dominated southern India. The Veerashaivas especially challenged caste hierarchies. They also challenged ideas about how religion could be practiced by developing this very radical theology that involved the personal worship of Shiva rather than the intercession of the great imperial temples or even the sub-imperial temples, which were really fashionable among the Deccan elite. So let's try to understand a little bit about how exactly these two religious traditions began to emerge and how was it that they kind of impacted the idea of state building in the medieval period. So let's begin. over to you. Can you tell us a little bit about the Veerashaivas? Who exactly are these people? Where do they come from? And how do they think about the unequal socio-political structures that dominate southern India at the time of their emergence?
Yeah, sure, Anirudh. I would say we can trace the origin of the Veerashaiva religion, or Lingayat religion rather, to the 12th century, to the mid-12th century. And in, as you were saying, the in the Deccan, you know, the northern part of Deccan rather, you know, around today, present-day Bidar, that is in Kalyana, where the Kalyani Chalukyas were the largest empire. And as you've been saying, you know, they controlled most of present-day Karnataka, into spilling into Telangana, and probably even present-day Andhra Pradesh as well. So such a very large empire. And they were, it was customary for them to build largely, mostly Shiva temples. You know, if you look at the Amruteshwara of Annigeri, or Dodda Basappa of Dandambal, or whatever. So there are, Shiva is probably the most popular god among, at least in the Deccan. But in the midst of all of this, it was clear that the patronage of these temples was built upon a very rigid, let's say, caste institution. And it was also parallel. I mean, the temples were not the only thing that these kings were patronizing, right? They were also having these Brahmadeyas, which were land grants, as you know, to Brahmins, which meant that there would be settlements controlled and taxed by Brahmin communities themselves. So there's this very unequal space that's been created. And breaking that fold, I think, is what the Lingayat religion does. And it starts with this one very, very almost, you know, worshipped really saint or philosopher, Basavanna, who is, I think, was born in around the 1130s. And he was a minister in the court of personal Bijladeva, who started this breakaway kingdom within the Kalyani Chalukya kingdom called the Kalachuri dynasty. And the name of Kalachuri itself is very interesting. I mean, there are so many of the Kalachuri dynasties, but let's stick with the Kalachuris who were ruling around the Kalyana area. And what Basava does is, first, he composes poems. That's one thing that we know for sure. But later hagiographies say that he almost started something called Kalyana Kranti, which is a revolution of Kalyana, which was apparently this great uprising of people of various castes who all had this one thing in common, that is allegiance to Shiva. But if you come back to his poetry, he envisaged Shiva as something that's experienced by the individual, and an essentially personal process, but which also involves some social integration, social interaction. And this is through this institution that he created called Anubhava Mandapa, apparently, where Anubhava, right? Anubhava is experience. So it is this, and sometimes it's, you know, defined as divine. And that's what's interesting, you know, using the same word for both experience and divine, that the divine is experienced. So in this one, Anubhava Mandapa, apparently, people of different castes and communities would compose poetry and discuss their understanding of God, and simultaneously strike down earlier written traditions on God. And the other important feature is that Shiva in this is worshipped entirely in his linga form. This is not to say that other temples had other forms, but it was primary linga across India, except, you know, there are a few exceptions here and there. But this linga would not be enshrined inside temples, and that is the most innovative aspect of this movement, I would say, but would be worn by the individual and through what's called the Ishtalinga, which is this small, you know, this small amulet kind of thing that's worn around the throat. And this meant that the Bhakta, the Lingayat, or Sharana, which is the person who is seeking the refuge of Shiva, is already with God. And this is also, by the way, the reason why Lingayats are not cremated but buried, because they do not need any process of purification. They're already with God. This is also a philosophical reason for this, and that is that these people believe in what's called the Jangama Shiva, which is the moving Shiva, which is nothing but human, as against the Sthavara Shiva, which is the stationary. So we have this in the Indian philosophical tradition, we have this, just like, you know, Aristotle or anybody in any part of the world, you have this clear distinction between mobile and stationary. So that's there in Indian philosophical tradition. They appropriate it and they try to, you know, they try to impose it on Shiva as well, and say, we worship the Jangama Shiva, which is the moving Shiva, and not the frozen or the immobile Shiva. And hence begins the Lingayat movement.
That's a very interesting point, Trivanth. And like, I can see why they would have initially have been referred to as Veerashaivas, right? Because it takes some real heroism to kind of defy the fundamental theology that this entire kind of imperial structure depends upon. Because so much about state building and political prestige really in the medieval Deccan was based around building temples to a stationary image of Shiva. The more elaborate your temple could be, the more kind of resources that you could give to it, the higher your rank within the political pecking order, right? And all of a sudden, if you have people who are coming up and saying that not only are these temples totally unnecessary, but Shiva is accessible to all people across all caste denominations, not just elites who are capable of constructing and kind of keeping these architectural spaces to themselves. It's very interesting to me how this deity, who up till this point had been kind of used almost as a state building mechanism, if I can use those terms, suddenly kind of being turned on his head and kind of being and becoming becoming the foundation of this kind of salvific idea that totally rejects the entire unequal kind of social structure under which his devotees live.
And since we've been discussing about states, as you know, a key feature of religious traditions anywhere in the world is the construction of hagiography or the consolidation of the faith. So what we have is a large spread of different poets from different backgrounds. But starting with Palkuriki Somanadaru, who was born in present-day Telangana, texts come to be written about the Lingayat saints. And his work was called Basava Puranamu, which is a hagiography of the various Lingayat saints who had existed till that point. And therefore, what he does there is consolidate the faith as an independent, self-sufficient faith. And the other thing he does is give it a clear history. You know, he builds a narrative into it. Because till now you have poems, but poems in themselves are not really narratives. They're just ideas. So what he does is builds a narrative. And Basava Puranam narrates this tale of Basava, conducting the marriage of a Madhika or a member from a Tanar caste and a Brahmin. And apparently that caused a backlash from both Brahmins as well as the state. And that led to what he claims is a Kalyana Kranti, which is the revolution of Kalyana. But we do not, it's too scanty, evidence to say that the Kalyana Kranti actually occurred. But what I think we see is this kind of juxtaposition or superimposition of a religious movement upon a parallel political process, which is a slow disintegration of the Kalyana state in any ways, right? And this clearly gives us an idea of what religious movements are all about. Irrespective of whether they were overtly political or not, they were being positioned, or expressed and described as political movements. That's the first point I would like to make. And next, I don't think there are Lingayat states, many number as far as I understand. But we have this one, we have the instance of the Kurg state, the Haleri Rajas, who were Lingayats by faith. But besides that, I think Lingayats became, through the centuries since then, a major sort of military force who would have a big role to play in the court, in the military, and thereby a major political force in general, even till the present.
That's very interesting, Revant. I mean, the story you're telling me is that basically the Kalyana state was disintegrating under many forces, including, for example, the rise of these powerful dynasts like Pichaladeva of the Kalachuris, as well as these new kind of religious movements that at least theologically, although we don't know precisely what they're doing in practice, at least theologically kind of shook the foundation of this kind of imperial Deccan structure to its roots, right? And this destruction of Kalyana as a result of the Veerashaivas is again, as you said, it's kind of debatable. But what we do know is that there isn't really a lot left of Kalyana today. There needs to be more archaeology done at the site, of course, but like there isn't really a lot left of the city. And like precisely how that happened is really up for debate. But it is interesting that this later individual in Telangana, I think he's within the Kakatiya territories, is sitting and trying to tell the story, because he's clearly, as every individual in history does, is really trying to tell a story for his own time, right? So it's very interesting that he would choose to tell that story, because perhaps the Veerashaivas by this point had kind of spread across more of the Deccan and were no longer kind of constrained to just the regions corresponding to northern Karnataka. It's interesting also that the hagiography is being told in the form of a quote-unquote a Purana. Therefore, kind of appropriating this kind of literary form that is very often associated with the quote-unquote great tradition to tell the story of what seems to have been a much more kind of broad-based movement. But we'll hopefully like come back to that in a little bit, because I'd like to talk about the other great religious tradition of southern India, the Sri Vaishnavas. But before we get to that, we just need to take a very quick ad break. And we're back. We are talking about the interaction of religion and state in medieval South India. We have just finished discussing the Veerashaiva religion and how it kind of challenged a lot of theological assumptions that medieval Deccan states were based on. And now we'll talk about another and perhaps equally influential religious tradition, namely the Sri Vaishnavas. So Prateek, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Sri Vaishnavas, and especially the way that the Sri Vaishnavas kind of engaged with the same questions that the Veerashaivas were doing, which is about inequality and caste hierarchy, which was so important to the maintenance of power in medieval India.
Right. So to, you know, kind of give a context of who the Sri Vaishnavas are. Sri Vaishnavas are a distinct, you know, a Vaishnava community, a Vishnu-worshipping community of South India. Well, today's Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, Andhra are their predominant, you know, areas where they're present. Of course, they moved to other parts as well. But yeah, and this community considers Narayana as their, you know, as their Brahman or Supreme Godhead, Ishvara. And the importance is given to Lakshmi as well, his consort. So hence the name Sri Vaishnava. And well, the tradition, if we see, we need to trifurcate the chronology of the Sri Vaishnavas to kind of understand how the textual process worked and how these textual processes framed what we know of the community. So one is the Alvar tradition. But when I say Alvars under the Sri Vaishnavas, there needs to be some amount of caution that is to be exercised by anybody who is referring to the Alvars in the context of Sri Vaishnavas, because the Alvars were simply poets who the term Sri Vaishnava or the community of Sri Vaishnava as a you know distinct social class or a social group did not exist during the period of Alvars, right from you know probably 6th to the 8th century. You know, that was not even there. So they are independent poets whose works were absorbed by the later Sri Vaishnava community. So that is one chunk. And then comes Ramanuja in the early 11th century. Who is forming the tradition, who becomes, I mean, for the Sri Vaishnavas, he is the founder, leader, you know, and he is like the figurehead of the tradition. And the one major feature of the tradition would be that of the Ubhaya Vedanta. So there's an interesting book called Vernacular Veda by Professor Vasudha Narayanan. She writes about how the Tamil corpus become equalized, you know, become gain stature as equal to the Vedas, you know, and thereby this concept of Ubhaya Vedanta of the Vedas and the Divya Prabandham or the Tamil corpus or the hymns of the Alvars being equal. And, that is kind of the base for the Sampradaya or the tradition, I would say. And what is important is when the tradition is trying to appropriate these hymns into its fold, saying, yes, these people belong to us, or rather we belong to them, you know, however you want to view it in an academic or a traditional sense. So what is happening is essentially there is a basis for rejecting caste in these poems itself, because these 12 people who are considered as the saint poets are an eclectic mix of all castes. Right? Kshatriyas are there, Brahmanas are there. And then you have Vellalas, who are the Chaturthas, the fourth caste. And you have Panas, who were denied entry into the temple, and hagiographies have it that by divine intervention, they were called inside and other things. So I'll just quote one poem of the Thondaredi Pudi Alvar to kind of give an insight into how the poetry kind of challenges this. அடிமையில் குடிமையில்லா அயல் சது பேதிமாரில் குடிமையில் கடமைப்பட்ட குக்கரில் பிறப்பரேலும் குடியினில் துளபம் வைத்தாய் முகிழர் கற்பு செய்யும் அடியரை உகத்தி போலும். So he says, even though there is a Brahmana who is, you know, performing all the rites and rituals and everything that is told in the Vedas perfectly, and then there is a person who is born in Kudimayil Kadamaipatta, in the last of the last caste, okay? Kukkaril Pirapperelam. Kukkar is Kshudra. Kshudra in Tamil is Kukkar. So it's like the least, you know, caste that is there. Even if somebody is born there, but then he has love towards you, oh Ranganatha, you're going to love him back and not the Brahmana. right? So this kind of question is there in the early corpus of the Alvars. Now, when Sri Vaishnavism is kind of building up itself from Ramanuja, he is having the hagiography of Ramanuja suggests that he's having these Tamil hymns as one of his inspirations, and he has a Vaishya guru who is great Vaishnava himself, but tradition does not consider him one of his five gurus. Maybe it's because of the caste. That's another intricate layer that we need to look into. So again, all of that, and his two predecessors, Alavandar especially, kind of, you know, there are these hagiographies that say he let inside a non-Brahmin into his matha or his building, and then said there is no ritualistic purification required because there is a non-Brahmin Vaishnava who has entered the matha, and that is enough. Right. So there are these aspects that question casteism that are presented before Ramanuja, which Ramanuja takes forward, and as the hagiography suggests, there is this huge change that he does. You know, but one thing that we need to, I like to contrast with what Revan said with regard to the Veerashaiva tradition, is that, see, Veerashaivism, in a sense, what I gather from Revan, because I'm not well read in that aspect, is kind of rejecting the whole Varna and Ashrama, stage. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Right.
But Sri Vaishnavism does.
That's how it seems to me as well. Yeah.
Yes. But Sri Vaishnavism does not do that, because Ramanuja is writing a commentary on the Vedanta, wherein he has to argue that the Smritis and the Shrutis, the Vedas and the subsequent Smritis, are Pramanas, are valid proofs. Otherwise, he's not going to be in the theological fold of the Vedic, cult. So he's essentially having to uphold it in his works, but his hagiography suggests otherwise. So it's this dichotomy that's very interesting in the Sri Vaishnava tradition. And to go post-Ramanuja is when this unique contribution, all of Ramanuja's works, by the way, although I've said that Tamil is regarded equally with the Vedas and, you know, the vernacular Veda and all of that, Ramanuja's works are all in Sanskrit. He has not written anything in Tamil. That's another interesting point. And in his work, in his Vedanta Bhashya, he clearly says, well, the non-Brahmin will not have access to Vedanta, right? So that's there. That is still there. And that's a very complicated equation that we need to analyze between his hagiography and his original works. Okay, that's something that's academically something that needs to be done.
There's a very interesting bunch of points, Pratik. And like, I think it's worth kind of sitting and like reflecting on them a little bit, right? Because there's always a tendency to think about history and religious figures as being fixed somehow. You know, we want to fit them into a single modern narrative that kind of suits the way that we think about medieval religions and states and empires and all these, you know, great saints, quote-unquote saints today. But what you're telling me is actually is that the picture is far more complex. In the first place, you have these rather, you know, these individual poets from various castes who, for whatever reason, proclaimed their devotion to various forms of Vishnu in the Tamil country in the 17th centuries. And now much, much later, in a totally different kind of social structure, which has much more established kind of socio-political structures for religion, you have this upper caste individual, Ramanuja, who's coming and saying, okay, so, I mean, I'm going to be taking all of these various poets, I'm going to be compiling them to kind of support my new theology, my new ideas about the worship of Vishnu. But in comparison to the Veerashaivas, who, I mean, I mean, it's interesting to speculate why. As you said, the Veerashaivas are much more kind of from the ground up. They are challenging the entire hierarchy and saying, you know, we don't believe in caste at all. It's very interesting to me that the Sri Vaishnavas, in some sense, do still believe in that hierarchy, and that this intercession of the supreme deity is kind of required for the devotees to enter into a temple. The temple itself still remains the premier space for the expression of devotion, unlike with the Veerashaivas. So in a sense, the Sri Vaishnava religion is more kind of intelligent and nuanced kind of response, it seems, to the social dynamics of the 11th, 12th centuries, in the sense that it is much more amenable to the structures of power that states at the time are based on. But it does, at least in theory, make some concessions to the new social realities, while at the same time retaining hierarchies, not just in terms of caste, but also in terms of the use of language. This idea that Ramanuja was still writing only in Sanskrit is a very interesting one. But tell us more. Tell us what happens to Sri Vaishnavism in the aftermath of Ramanuja.
So, yes. So, post-Ramanuja, what happens is there is more of a commentarial tradition that emerges. And, you know, the magnum opus is considered Thiruvaimuzhi of Nammazhar, who is incidentally from the Vellala caste, which belongs to the Chaturtha Varna. And what is going to happen is there is going to be a schism in the sect that's going to emerge. And one is going to uphold, it's a very prima facie view. There's a lot of nuance to this. I'd suggest reading Patricia Mummy on this topic. She has a wonderful book on this. So what happens is there's going to be a schism that's going to, you know, and it's going to lead to a point where, a new language of communication of writing works is emerging. It's the Manipravala. So Manipravala is, I think it embodies Sri Vaishnavism as a whole, even as in the structure of the language, because there is going to be Tamil, there is going to be Sanskrit mixed with one another, like you can't separate them. Like the case endings of Sanskrit used for Tamil words, case ending of Tamil used for Sanskrit words, and then you put, you know, them together and create a new language, right? So that is one language that in which the Sri Vaishnava texts are written post-Ramanuja. Ramanuja himself, according to hagiographies, is said to have ordered his Sishya called Pillan to author a commentary on the Thiruvaimuzhi. So that is there. So this Manipravala kind of embodies Sri Vaishnavism, as I say. Because the Sanskrit Vedas, Tamil Vedas, put together is my sampradaya, and that is reflected in the languages itself, you know. And it's a very interesting thing to use language itself as a tool to convey your ideology. If you can view it that way. But going along, so there are going to be these circumstances post-Ramanuja where there is a text called Sri Vachana Bhushanam that is written by Pillai Lokacharya. And Pillai Lokacharya is, you know, in the 13th century, 1205 to 1311 is his period. So what happens is, he questions this caste hierarchy and he uses very interesting, tools to say, let's take death. He uses death as a tool to say, you see, Jatayu, who is just a bird to whom, you know, death ceremonies were performed by Rama himself. And he goes on to quote his predecessors and say, oh, there were these, Chaturthas to whom, just because they had the Shankha Chakra, you know, mudra on their shoulders, which is the initiation ritual mark, my acharyas, my gurus have done death rituals for bodies which they've found, not bothering that they did not even know the caste, you know. So there are these things. So he used just such very interesting tools to say, you know, the lowest of the low ritual is the death ritual. If God and my preceptors can go to that irrespective of caste or whether you're even a human being or a bird, what are you even doing? You know, these are questions that he raises. His brother Azhagiya Manavala Perumal Nayanar, that's a very interesting book that he writes. It's called Acharya Hridayam. It will go on to place Nammazhar, who is a Chaturtha, superior to Krishna and Vedavyasa, and say that, you know, nothing doing. You just imagine there is a place where butter is smelly, and then there is a that is of Krishna. Then Vedavyasa, who is the son of a fisherwoman, where it stings a fish. Look at Alvar, there is this, you know, Tulasi that is so fragrant. You know, that's how he's going to go on and say, glorify him more than even Krishna and Vyasa, to say, don't look at caste. You know, it's what he said that matters. So that is going to be the position of the Sri Vaishnava. Not considering it as a monolith, Tushan, and the building up of all of this is very, very interesting. It's a very nuanced, you know, narrative which have just compressed it into a very, very prima facie account.
No, it is definitely an interesting account, Pratik. And like, I think you have touched upon some interesting nuances here. But to me, at least, you know, like kind of looking at this perhaps with a more kind of modern perspective, since I'm not as familiar with the text as you clearly are, it seems to me that like while these very interesting and challenging ideas are being put forth, they still seem to exist primarily within the realm of this kind of top-down view of society, where you have elites who are trying to say, okay, so maybe we should be doing things a little differently, rather than this kind of bottom-up approach that the Vidyashaivas have. Do you think that that's an accurate way of presenting this?
I'll definitely agree with you. I'll also put forth another supporting, argument for this. So, see, in the commentary, let's take the work of Thirupan Alvar, who is a person who is not allowed in hagiography, of course. Who is not allowed inside the temple, but he has a lot of devotion. And hence, he is now allowed inside the temple. And he says, no, I will not step into the temple because I belong to this lower caste. And therefore, the Brahmin priest says, don't worry, you don't have to set foot inside the temple. Climb on my shoulder and I will take you inside. Right? So that way, your feet are not placed in the temple, but still you are inside the temple as per the wishes of God. Right? So the commentary, if you see, most interesting part is, it says, it's natural for a person from the lower caste to be subservient to God because subservience is inherent in them. The nuance that... So you see, I mean, even in the case of bhakti for that matter, why do these alvars adorn the role of a woman to speak as, you know, woman pining in love towards Bhagavan, who is the male, right? The commentaries say, well, servitude is there in womanhood, right? And therefore, that's going to...
This is something you guys touched upon in Pravaha as well. And like, yes. It's ridiculous. I mean, let's not bandy with the word. It is ridiculous.
It's interesting how the tradition uses the same tool to challenge it.
I mean, yeah, that's one way of putting it. Like, I have a rather more, I think that it's using a negative stereotype to advance a positive, to kind of challenge a particular stereotype in a way. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to, I don't know, the fact that this is happening in the first place seems to suggest a very a wide-ranging kind of upper or elite attitude towards the lower caste and towards women, right? Is that even though these quote-unquote enlightened ideas are being advanced, they're being advanced in a way that is, you know, I would say far less than pleasant to be diplomatic
but
about.
We will be accused of anachronism perhaps, but yes.
Of course, yeah, fair enough. These are, of course, like medieval elites. Like, it's not necessarily historically accurate to kind of hold them to our modern standards,
right?
Which is a fair point. But let's try to come back to this the initial theme that we kind of set out on, right? Which is to kind of talk about the differing responses of states to these different religious traditions. Now, Revanth, you spoke a little earlier about how there aren't any quote-unquote Lingayat states, right? But perhaps you and Prateek, very briefly, since we're kind of running out of time for this podcast, if you could give us a sense of how was it that these religious traditions with the kind of social and political ideas that they kind of embodied were incorporated by state structures in the centuries that followed Basavanna and Ramanuja?
So the state and the Sri Vaishnavism is a really interesting point. The state seems to have had a problem more with the worship of Vishnu rather than the challenge of caste in the case of Sri Vaishnavism. So you take Kulothunga II, who is a very serious Shaiva advocate, or rather, I mean, although the other kings were Shaiva advocates, Shaiva followers, he was an anti-Vaishnava, let's put it that way. So that's going to force Ramanuja to move out of the Chola country into the Hoysala country. And hagiography has it that Vishnuvardhana of the Hoysalas became a Sishya of Ramanuja, and he converted from Jainism to Sri Vaishnavism and to construct temples of Ramanuja. So that's the more to do with Shaiva, Vaishnava, problems, the caste equation, as was the case with the Veerashaivas. But as far as the social scenario is concerned, there is a lot of things against these people that is happening in a non-political manner, in the sense attempts of killing Ramanuja, etc. are happening because he's challenging caste and he's bringing in non-Brahmins into his sacred spaces and all of that. So that is happening in a non-political sphere. But whereas the interaction with state is concerned, it is mostly to do with theology rather than caste in Sri Vaishnavism, I would say.
Interesting. And what about Veerashaivism?
So as I've said earlier, I don't think there are Sri Vaishnava, Lingayat states as such, but instead, Lingayats are a prominent community. Therefore, there is, I think, the state's interaction with Lingayatism is by the virtue of the popularity of the faith, really. And the other thing is that the fact that there aren't temples, that the Lingayats do not occupy temples, because they're exactly, it's precisely to oppose that they're created, means that there is also, that link is completely missing. But I think this kind of anti-Brahmin plus sort of Shaiva attitude becomes a kind of, is capitalized by some states. For example, Rudramadevi is a very famous, I think, I don't know if you can call her Lingayat, but I think you find a shade of Veerashaivism in her, and also in the policies of the Kakatiyas. In the administration, they invited lots of Velamas, that is the Velanadu Kapus of the Krishna Delta, into their administration, and it was somewhat de-Brahminized thing. And also, even in the policy, it was done. You know, if you compare them with, let's say, both the Hoysalas or the Yadavas of Maharashtra, which are all, you know, contemporaneous, there's much less temple patronage. So in that, I think there is some connection between Veerashaivism and statehood.
I would just like to add one thing. The later aftermath of Ramanuja, I mean, with the advent of Vijayanagaras, of course, the interaction with Sri Vaishnavism and the state is very heavy. I mean, we know Amukta Malyada, composed by Krishnadevaraya, has a lot of Sri Vaishnava influence over it. And I would also, there's this pan Vaishnava narrative between the Madhvas and Sri Vaishnavas under the Vijayanagara patronage. There is a very interesting book by Valery Stoker on this topic, which I would refer to here.
And of course, also if you include temples as a, you know, Sri Vaishnava controlled temples, then almost all of them are completely patronaged by
Vijayanagaras. Yes.
And if you just go to any other temple, it's so obvious that everything's most of the current structure is built between the Vijayanagara Nayaka.
Yes, yes. And the Nayakas and the Marathas have extended a lot of patronage.
Okay, this has been a really interesting conversation. Like, I really want to thank you guys for taking us through what is obviously a very complicated religious landscape and kind of drawing out these interesting implications from it, right? For me, the two biggest takeaways, of course, are the kind of bottom-up approach of the Veerashaivas versus the top-down approach of the Sri Vaishnavas and the differing ways in which kind of states react to them, which is, at least in the case of the Kakatiyas, to kind of incorporate Veerashaivas into the ruling elite, whereas the Sri Vaishnavas actually go on to, partially, of course, because the theology is much more amenable to temples, which were major nodes of power for medieval Indian states, continue to develop this alliance with the state as it were, well into the Vijayanagara period. And of course, the Lingayat tradition. Both remain major religious and political forces in India's political landscape today. So this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you both for joining me. Let me just briefly remind all of our listeners that Sakshila Institution is doing a course on evidence-based policymaking for responding to COVID-19. It'll be happening over the last couple of weeks of October, and our deadline for applications on the 17th. So that's something you guys should definitely check out. And we also have our India's Global Outlook survey, which we're very curious about, like the way that you think that India should be approaching the geopolitical challenges that it faces in the 21st century. All of this is a very hard departure from the religious politics of the 11th century, I know. But hopefully, if you click on the links in the description, you will find them interesting as well. And as I said early in the podcast, I will be putting a link to Pravaha in the description of this podcast. So I highly recommend that you check it out, because to me, at least, there is nothing more enjoyable than just listening to a bunch of Indian history nerds just geeking about things that they love. So thank you to both of you fellow nerds for joining me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Anirudh.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for inviting us.
And thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.